So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bearers Ask an Expert podcast. So hello, everyone. My name is Cindy Blackstock. I'm Gitsan, and I'm really honored to join you from the unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin Territory here in Ottawa. And I am joined by the fabulous Spirit Bear. And of course, that's really important because it's the Spirit Bear podcast. You heard that right. P-A-W cast. And his mother, Mary, is here supervising. And that's the way that it should always be. I come from a matrilineal culture, so we always knew men wanted the power and women should control it. And that's why I'm really honored that today we are on a panel with some fabulous women who can help us untangle some of these questions about something called the Act Respecting First Nations, Métis, Inuit, Children, Youth, and Families. Yeah, that's a mouthful. And it's a piece of federal legislation that sets national standards for Indigenous children coming into contact with child welfare, but also sets a pathway towards affirming the jurisdiction of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities in the area of child and family services. It's more commonly called C-92 because it is such a mouthful to say. So today we will be talking about it as if it was C-92 for the most part. So you might hear us talk about the Act or C-92. It's the same thing. But there was a huge Supreme Court decision on this Act, and I don't want to give away all the stuff. So, you know, we'll hear more from our special guests who are joining us today, who are both very serious friends of Spirit Bear and his family. The first is Naomi Natalik. She's from the Listigouche First Nation, which is in Mi'kma'ki territory on the Gaspé coast of Quebec. She is a par excellence Aboriginal lawyer. She's the chair of Aboriginal Law and Policy at Dalhousie University. And she's also an Aboriginal Law Certificate Coordinator at Dalhousie University. On top of all that, she has been co-counsel with Spirit Bear at the Supreme Court on the C-92 case. So like that should be the top of her intro thing there. But she's just does so much fabulous work for First Nations communities and across the country. So it's a real honor to have Naomi here. And then also we are blessed to have Hadley Friedland. Hadley's an associate prof of Faculty of Law at the University of Alberta, and her research focuses on Indigenous law, family law, child welfare law, criminal justice law. Like she does all of this stuff. And you know what? That's important because so much of our lives are interdisciplinary, right? We have to pull from these different ways of thinking in order to capture the lived experience of people. And she's also the academic director and the principal director and co-founder of the Wakotan Lodge and Governor's Lodge. And I want you to really pay attention to that. They have got some fabulous resources on C-92. Hadley and Naomi have cooperated on some of these resources. So check out their website. And we'll make sure that we put that in the link so that you don't, if you can't find it on Google, you'll be able to find it here. So let's get started, because I know I have like tons of questions. And Spirit Bear's been telling me he has tons of questions for both of you. Maybe we'll start with you, Naomi, about a general thing. Why do we even need an act to affirm the jurisdiction of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples in child welfare?
The answer is we've always had that, but a part of the answer is that we still live in a country where colonialism has had an impact and continues to have an impact. And for a very, very long time, our jurisdiction was ignored or denied, you know, that sometimes, you know, men communities were exercising it in ways that may not be seen, but the state of Canada for a really long time has not recognized that. And although we have the recognition of Section 35 of the Constitution that says that Aboriginal and treaty rights are recognized and affirmed, the Supreme Court of Canada has interpreted that. We've had it for about 30-some years. And it is yet to be interpreted in a court decision to find a right to self-government in many areas. Really, the court said it's possible, but they hadn't found any yet. We have had communities that have negotiated self-government agreements. But again, it's a very slow and long process. Same problem with the courts. And this is something that the Supreme Court picked up on and that we made arguments about in the case, that because of, you know, everything that's happened in child welfare and the crisis of overrepresentation, there's a real need, right? That well-being and self-government and jurisdiction and self-determination go hand in hand. And we can talk more about what that looks like too after, but that those things need to happen and that the processes that currently exist that recognize it are too slow. And it's having a real impact, and that there was pressure, especially after the main decision in Caring Society. People were saying there's got to be a way forward. There's got to be a different way forward. And so pressuring the federal government to pass legislation. And our friend, now Judge Sebastian Grammel, wrote an excellent paper about why we needed to have legislation. He drew on the fact that there's legislation in the U.S. like this, ICWA and the Indigenous Child Welfare Act, Indian Child Welfare Act. And so we need it because there wasn't really anything filling the gap. But unfortunately, we still live in, you know, a society that still has aspects of colonialism ongoing. And so we needed a piece of legislation, I think, to help other governments see that they need to step up and to help facilitate the exercise of our jurisdiction.
It's baffling, isn't it? That after, you know, for thousands of years, First Nations, Métis and Inuit peoples looked after their own kids in their own laws. And then Canada took over and we had residential schools, which had horrible impacts for those children. And then the provinces took a swipe at it and we had the 60s scoop. And so we've seen these two governments really not succeed at honoring our children. And yet they still don't want to see that we actually have jurisdiction in those areas. Like, it's still a struggle to get them to recognize that those pieces, right? Hadley, when you think about this new act, and it has this other bucket, which are these national standards. Before C-92 came along in about 2019, there were all these provincial pieces of legislation, they had some standards in there. So why did we need new standards, national standards in C-92? And what are those national standards?
I feel like the national standards are a bit overlooked in this act. One of the things I appreciated about the Supreme Court decision is they talked about the national standards and the affirmation of jurisdiction being interwoven and how important that is. I mean, we know part of the national standards came from the call to action in the TRC final report saying it's important. And Naomi actually started this, and Claire Truesdale's in the Supreme Court reference updated, looking at all the provinces' standards to see how they matched up with the national standards. And the bottom line is the national standards are meant as a basement, a floor, not a ceiling. And it was just to try to bring everybody up, because when you look across all the provinces, you can see that it's not uniform across provinces. You can't guarantee that those national standards were being met in each province. So some provinces go above and beyond, but some aren't even at that basement floor. So I think those national standards give that base, saying who's ever delivering services, these are ways to keep focused on the well-being of Indigenous children. So, and a few of them that stand out, a real focus on prevention. They have placement priorities, which is similar to ICWA in the States. And they really stress the relationships, the importance of relationship for Indigenous children and maintaining those throughout.
So some of those national standards are things like cultural continuity, substantive equality, best interests of the child, that kind of stuff. And it goes across the country. So substantive equality can sometimes be a tough one to understand, Hadley and Naomi. So can you help us understand what substantive equality is and why it's so important in First Nations Child and Family Services or Inuit Child and Family Services or Métis Child and Family Services?
Whenever I think of substantive equality, I love to go back to the definition that comes from the CHRT in the main decision in the Caring Society case. The paragraph is like 496. I've cited it so many times, but it talks about substantive equality not just being about mirroring of provincial standards. And that's so important because for the longest time, the way Canada and the provinces have not only sort of dealt with child welfare, but other areas like social assistance and housing and education, they say that they're following provincial standards. So they refer to this concept called comparability. They're being comparable to the provinces, although it's been found by the Auditor General and in the Caring Society case that, in fact, Canada has never actually studied that, doesn't know, and actually is not meeting that. And Canada was trying to say, well, that's the standard and we're meeting it. And they say, no, you're not even meeting that standard in child welfare or in other areas. But more than that, the tribunal says that's formal equality. That's treating, you know, like you're just like everyone else. But in fact, equality means recognizing the difference and the needs. And so it's more of a needs-based approach, and it refers to historical, cultural, and geographical needs of First Nations communities in the Caring Society case. And to me, that's how I see it. It's about celebrating difference, recognizing difference, and accommodating it, and recognizing those different types of needs that people have and meeting them at those needs. And then so when it comes to things like Jordan's principle, it's not just ensuring that Indigenous folks get what children in the provinces get. That's the bare minimum. But beyond that, it needs to be services that meet their needs and circumstances, historical, geographic, and cultural.
I think in a nutshell, where that all leads is saying it's about equality in the result, in the outcome for Indigenous children, as opposed to equality in what goes into things. It's equality in those outcomes and results.
Well, that's really helpful. So there's lots of good stuff in this federal act, in this C-92 act. But what are some of the shortfalls?
This act is short on details. And I would say as time goes on, as people are applying it, there's three major areas that are coming up. And none of these are surprising to any of us because, to be honest, all three of us flagged these in 2019. One is funding. Funding's a huge issue. There isn't a funding formula. There isn't a way to address and ensure in the act. I mean, it's aspirational. It's saying if, you know, looking at coordination agreements, you know, it says really important things about substantive equality, but there isn't a way to ensure that happens, and there isn't a must. So that's a big gap. And I think that's coming up with First Nations and other Indigenous governments sitting at coordination tables across the country. Comes up again and again. And it also comes up around the national standards, where there's that pushing, you know, counter to Jordan's principle, where we're seeing some of that bickering coming from provinces saying, okay, but who funds these, making sure these national standards are in place. So funding's big. The other big issue is enforcement. There's questions as this act is being applied. We're starting to see case law where judges are saying, we see this wasn't followed, this wasn't done right. But in the end, we're not quite sure what to do about that. And Naomi has some great tips about that. But I think the act itself, if there was something a little more robust, that would be helpful. And then the third, if I can just say, there's still no regulations for this act. And that's something we hear across the border. So ICWA has been in place for 40 years. But the folks there that talk about implementation say regulations, I believe, came in place 2 years ago now or 3 years ago. So, you know, waiting over 30 years to have those regulations. And they said, what a huge difference to have those regulations for courts to be able to pick it up and actually apply it. And I think that's really important on this side of the border to have those in place so people can have a roadmap for applying it.
Yeah, those are excellent points. And one of my concerns, like, I feel like an old saw on this one, but, you know, I think there is a fine line between self-government and offloading by governments. Sufficient funding has to go with acknowledging the inherent right to self-government and child and family. Because otherwise you have a beautiful law on paper that you can't really live up to. And that's another broken promise for kids. This point about regulations is really key. And of course, this is the fifth year since the act was in place. And I think there was a plan for some fifth-year review, but we haven't seen that come about yet.
I was just looking at the regulations provision while Hadley was talking, and I know that there's supposed to be one about dispute resolution, right? And I guess there's a power more generally. So it'd be interesting to sort of think about what other types of regulations that would be super helpful. But I think that and the fact that there is right now no dispute resolution and still like areas of dispute, we've heard from colleagues and friends who are, you know, at tables, at coordination tables about people, governments taking sort of hardline positions on stuff and disputes about what the act means. Some of that's been clarified by the Supreme Court's decision. That's really helpful. And we can talk about more of that after. But as you know, Hadley and I worked on a report with Shelby Thomas about that they would be really helpful to have oversight of this act, as well as Jordan's principle and ISC more generally, and having some sort of tribunal that would actually be able to, because we're still in a power imbalance, no matter how, you know, despite the usefulness of this act, we're still in a power imbalance with other governments. I think that, you know, some of those gaps are maybe starting to be closed a bit, but there's still gaps, and the funding is a huge part of it. And so we need better dispute resolution mechanisms. And I don't know if whatever they have planned for the regulations is going to cut it. You know, that our view is that we need something with a good amount of teeth and power to really be able to provide good oversight and enforcement. So getting to some of those points. I guess one piece that wasn't mentioned that I think is really key too is that there was not really much funds at all towards education and training for members of the legal system that are engaging with this act. So judges, lawyers. And so, you know, the way COTA went launched through Hadley and her leadership, they've really been like off the side of their justice, developing all kinds of great resources. So that kudos, and it's so wonderful. There's such a need. But the fact that there isn't this, they're doing all kinds of presentations with different groups. But that's a huge area where like there are rights in the act that lawyers who work for legal aid and who work for families could be using and aren't using because they don't understand it, or they don't know of it, or they don't know how to use it properly. Same with some judges. I have found that I'm having more judges come and going to do presentations on C92. So I think there's a cadre of judges anyway who are taking this very seriously and really want to make sure. But judges can't just act on their own, right? They need lawyers to show them the path. And I feel like still there's so many lawyers who don't understand this act or not even aware of it and aren't using it to its fullest capacity in order to make arguments for their clients.
Those are important points. And those are all things that can be fixed, is the important thing. And we want to see Canada do that review, develop these regulations in partnership with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, and really rely on the good, strong technical skill that's out there in First Nations, Métis, and Inuit Child and Family Services, because some of the First Nations agencies in particular have been operating for over 50 years. So there's a good track record and excellent people out there who could help work with lawyers like yourselves and shape some of those regulations so they have that effect. Now, we have this challenge that went to the Supreme Court. So you can't just show up at the Supreme Court and get a ruling. There has to be somebody kind of who said, well, this law, We don't agree with all of it or part of it, and they then launch a legal challenge. So Naomi, can you help us understand the law gets passed, and then who brings a legal challenge and why?
I teach constitutional law, and it's usually that this actor brings a lot of legal challenges to legislation. And anyway, so the government of Quebec. In particular, and it may have been even before it's, I can't remember now. I know that Hadley and I and another scholar wrote an article shortly about saying we thought that the challenge was misguided, but the government of Quebec, as it often does, will challenge federal legislation as being unconstitutional. They went at this act. They tried to argue that Canada could not pass legislation that directed provincial public servants about how to do their job, because the national standards not just apply, you know, they apply to provincial actors. They also apply to First Nations and other Indigenous actors within the child welfare system. But they said, well, to the extent that it, you know, tells us what to do, it can't do that. The Supreme Court disagreed, and so did the Court of Appeal. And they also said that the federal government could not recognize in legislation the inherent right to self-government and set out a pathway as it has in the act to exercising that right. And their argument was sort of relying on the neglect of the past. They're like, They argue that, because Canada never legislated in this area, because there hasn't been a legal case and nobody's taken this to court to find a legal case, and because it's all just been negotiated up to this point, and there's only been a few treaties that actually even touch on this, and because Canada insists that the province had to be at the table, they said, see, we either have to be at the table or you got to go to court. Federal government can't just pass legislation in order to, address this issue on its own. And thankfully, the court also said, no, that's not right.
Yeah. And like what strikes me is I can't see a direct line between any of Quebec's arguments and actually trying to improve the well-being of First Nations, Métis, or Inuit children. It all seems kind of rather in that whole nexus of what do we as a province control versus over what the federal government controls. Is that a fair characterization?
That's right, Cindy. It was all about power.
All about power.
All about power, you know, and I'm so glad that I was able with Dave Taylor, your wonderful counsel in the CHRT stuff, to do this together. And we really tried to really say, remember the kids. This is about the kids.
Yeah. And that's what Spirit Bear is all about, is trying to remind us, you know, like sometimes when you're involved in this stuff, you can notionally say, of course, we're working for children, but you really need to kind of think about what difference does this decision make at the level of the child? In order to really have a lot of integrity with this statement about looking after kids, we need to make sure that whatever we're doing, we actually have children whose lives are better at the end of that. And if their lives are not better, then we need to, as adults, rethink what we're doing. And that's what was really missing even in the arguments that Quebec was putting forward. It was really about them. It wasn't about the children. And I was so happy that you and others were there to represent the kids. This thing makes its way to the Supreme Court and there's a hearing. It was interesting for me when I was looking at that because you have Canada and Quebec are the two main parties. And then you had a bunch of interveners there. The Caring Society was an intervener. And then the court sat on it for like 12 months. And I'll just say for myself, I was kind of nervous with the amount of time that the court took to make its decision. But then the decision comes out. And what are some of the highlights of that decision for you, Hadley?
Well, one of the reasons I wonder if it took so long is it was a unanimous decision. So the court wrote as a court. There was no dissent. There was no split court, which I thought sent a pretty powerful message from the court. The court really, you know, you're talking about like, yeah, in the end, does this decision affect the well-being of Indigenous children? And throughout this decision, I mean, the court came back to that. I'm not talking about the substantive law right now, but just the idea that the court, I felt like the court really focused on the well-being of Indigenous children, came back to it again and again, and really stressed, you know, they said all governments need to center the well-being of Indigenous children. That needs to be a common goal. In some ways, I thought they did a little chiding maybe of that focusing on who has the power and instead saying you need to be using your power for this common goal of the well-being of Indigenous children. I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, that's actually really, really true. And that's what responsible traditional leadership was all about too, right? Is that where you had a little bit more than other people, you were to use it for the common good. And it's great to see the court kind of affirm that. Naomi, what were your highlights out of that decision?
There's a lot, actually. So I'll pick a few that sort of come to the top of my head too. Definitely that it being unanimous. And I was worried about how long it was taking too, Cindy. And it's actually this particular composition of the court. They don't often all come together. Like that took work. So now that I look at it in hindsight, I'm like, oh, it's because that took work and they were really working because they wanted to speak as a unified voice. I think the themes, in addition to children, the themes of the reconciliation and sort of a new vision of what reconciliation is really comes out strong. In fact, I did a control alt find sort of search. Reconciliation comes up over 60 times in the decision.
Wow.
You know, sometimes that's in reference to the TRC, but most of the time it's just like talking about the idea of it. And they don't go back to their old cases where they talk about reconciliation, which people have pointed out is not really reconciliation. It's more like conciliation or balancing. But here they're like using the talk of the TRC about mutually respectful relations, about the UN Declaration as being the framework for reconciliation. And this is like the one of the most mind-blowing things was reading it. I just kept going, wow, wow, wow. In like paragraph two or three, they're just like, yep, the UN Declaration applies in positive law of Canada. And like throughout the decision, so many articles of UNDRIP are woven into the decision. And I guess another part that I really like is they use this metaphor of weaving. They draw on UNDRIP for this and the TRC, but they say, you know, reconciliation is about the weaving of state law, of international law, and Indigenous law. And that comes from a book that came out a few years ago that a bunch of Indigenous scholars wrote in, but they talked about this braiding of legal orders. But they gave voice to that and actually referenced that braiding metaphor throughout the decision, which was, I thought, really something. So those are sort of my top three, but there's a lot. Oh, okay. Actually, I'll take a fourth. And you'll probably get to it, but you know, one part I really wasn't expecting, and because no one really argued it, but they did something that I didn't see. They didn't go like, we can talk about how they decided this on section 9124 on the federal jurisdiction, but they found that Canada had the federal jurisdiction to pass this, but they also emphasized obligation and responsibilities. And in a way, so what they did is they brought in the concept of the honor of the crown, and they said, Canada, essentially, this is my way of saying it. If you want to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk. If you're going to say that self-government exists, you cannot deny that it exists at tables or anything like that. Like, you got to embrace it and you've got to live up to the promises that you're making in this. I think there's a lot of potential for that. So that, I guess, is my fourth thing, but I'll stop now.
Well, that's an important fourth thing, because I think bringing that into alignment, right? We've seen a lot of statements by this government in particular that on their face are very welcoming. But sometimes I found in our Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case, their legal submissions are very contrary to what these promising statements are politically. So bringing that into alignment is really important. And having said that, that gives me a worry to add my one, and that is Jordan's principle. I was so happy to see the court actually mention Jordan's principle specifically in its decision. Because one of the things that the Act, I think, also could benefit by in terms of an amendment would be a coordinating function amongst the various laws that are now operating in child and family services across the country to make sure that there's, if we have children, for example, that are subject to a First Nations law and then they move to another province, that there's an ability for that First Nations law to still have some level of care over that child. So that kind of coordination of laws is something that's very important. And I think that that's part of the reason that the court put that in there on Jordan's principle. So we got this decision. And before the decision came out, I was hearing a lot about, you know, around these tables, the coordination tables, by the way, if you hear that term, that's those tables where there's a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit group sitting at the table negotiating their own jurisdiction and child and family. And I had heard something about subsidiary federal law, which was really having me scratch my head because, you know, as a non-lawyer, I know that federal law typically trumps provincial law. And what the feds were saying is even though the Act has this provision that says that where there's any tension between the provincial law and the First Nations law will prevail, their view was that that only applied in the province where the First Nation resided, and that in order to have it apply nationally, they had to go strike all these agreements with all these different provinces and territories, including ones that aren't big fans of the Act, like Quebec. Do you think they still could do that, given the Supreme Court's decision?
That position coming from the federal government, that First Nation and other Indigenous governments have to negotiate a coordination agreement with every single province and territory in order for their law to have force in there, is one of those that I think, again, goes back to your point of, you know, how does this affect the well-being of Indigenous children? How does this center what they need? And you can just see that that creates such huge practical barriers. So I've been thinking this through too, and Naomi might jump in and see it in a clearer way. I think them talking about subsidiary federal law was always incorrect in law, in my understanding. And the Supreme Court does talk about, in the Act, it basically says if an Indigenous government has a law negotiates in good faith a coordination agreement or tries to negotiate for a year, that law then at the end of that year or at the end of that coordination agreement has the force of federal law. And having the force of federal law means that if there's a conflict or contradiction with any provincial law, that law would prevail. So it seems to me that if that happens, even with one province, once that act has the force of federal law, it has the force of federal law. It would be paramount. It would prevail over any of the provinces. That's the way it's actually always seemed to me. And it seems to me that the Supreme Court really stressed, you know, of course, the federal government is able to do this. It's something called incorporation by reference. Governments can do this at any time. It seems to me that that position cannot be correct. But I'll defer to Naomi, if you see a wiggle room that I don't.
I completely agree with Hadley's take on that. And, you know, I mean, if the feds wanted that to be the law, they should have said it in the law, right? You don't get to make up new law after you've passed the law, right? Or come up with these interpretations that seem really like, you know, as Hadley was saying, like they're harmful. They're going to require that, especially when like the law actually doesn't require a coordination agreement. The law doesn't in order for an Indigenous law to have effect as federal law, just the effort after a year. So that would be completely contrary to the purpose of the law. So it makes no sense. And I think now what you can especially turn to is the language of the court that has basically said, and I'm just getting, So Parliament has bound the federal government to the position it has affirmed as a matter of statutory positive law, essentially an undertaking to act as though Indigenous peoples enjoy an inherent right to self-government in relation to child and family services. And it affirms also that the Crown undertakes to act in accordance with its positions that self-government was recognized, and it can no longer assert in any proceedings or discussions that there is no Indigenous right to self-government. Again, this is the walk and the talk, right? And so I think now it's going to be very easy to shut down some of that silliness, if you'll allow me to call it that.
I think it's pretty silly, especially because we have need to remind people that we have some First Nations communities that have been literally just cut across these borders. So they could be part in Quebec and part in Ontario. And if this, if the federal government regime's land, you'd have half the people affected by your law, but not the other half. Like, it makes no sense. So I agree with you completely. This brings me to another thing that never makes any sense to me, and that's a lack of money to do any of this. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but I'm wondering if you see the federal government was taking the position that, well, we're subject to these Canadian Human Rights Tribunal orders, but we're not going to be subject to them if you bring down your own law. That frees us up from having any obligations under the tribunal. That was kind of one of their positions. How do you think this decision, if at all, impacts Canada's funding obligations?
Well, I mean, it does give us some arguments. It's not as clear on the face of it, you know. But I think there's this decision coming, right? So the Dominic decision is heading to the Supreme Court in April. And Cindy, I don't know if you've heard from Dave, but we did get word yesterday that we are allowed. We have been approved as an intervener.
Well, so fabulous!
Yes,
going to be there again.
Yes, absolutely. So that's in April, and it sort of seemed the way they were talking about the honor of the crown and sort of saying how the Canada had bound itself, that it was setting up this issue to be decided further in this case. And so the case is a little different, but it touches on all the same principles. So the Dominic case is about the funding of self-administered policing services in a First Nation that were chronically underfunded. They have a CHRT order as well. And then, you know, and they also tried to make an argument that the honor of the crown required the government to actually fund on the basis of substantive equality, not just, you know, whatever they said, you know, they could fund at the time. So I think that's going to get out a lot of the same issues. And hopefully, like, we bring to the courts, like, how important this issue is. You can't really have effective self-government if there's no funds for this, right? UNDRIP speaks about that, you know, not only do we have the right, inherent right to self-govern, but the ways and means of financing that. So, you know, UNDRIP speaks to the, you know, the need to have meaningful self-government that has to require government government funding in this regard. And so I think, you know, those issues are coming square soon to be in front of the Supreme Court. I also just wanted to touch on this idea that, you know, this resiling from their human rights obligations and trying to make a distinction once you sign a coordination agreement that the human rights, you know, requirements are no longer. I don't think Canada can do that. I know it tries to do that, but I don't think that you can sign away your human rights and the obligation for adequate funding.
Especially when the act itself, C-92, includes respect for the, you have to uphold the Canadian Human Rights Act. So that can't just apply to First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. It's got to apply to Canada too.
That's right. And I also, I mean, it's not honorable, right? It's not honorable to say, if you want a coordination agreement, we want out of our human rights obligations. I think the other argument is that interwoven on that idea of the braid, the Supreme Court really stressing that it's not about downloading, but it's really about that interweaving, where it doesn't mean that provincial and federal governments can throw up their hands and say and give up responsibilities here.
Yeah, and that's the Jordan's principle that they brought in too.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're sitting back and you're thinking about that, we have First Nations, Métis, and Inuit governments kind of across the country thinking about exercising jurisdiction, or maybe they're sitting at one of these tables. What are some of the kind of top things you would have in mind for them, or tips that they should be thinking about as they undertake that important work?
Don't feel rushed. And I think also, like, the longevity of this is not, I think, you know, because of the potential of a looming changing government in a year or two from now, like, that you need to do all of this before the changing government, because then if it's a new government with a more conservative stripes, then the money's all gone and we're done. And that's, you know, we got to take what we can get. And I think that that's a really, don't feel that pressured like this. Like, I think, you know, barring, you know, repeal of the legislation, which I think will then could raise a whole bunch of other challenges and then maybe other, but we'll, let's park that, because I think it's unlikely, it's politically unpalatable, and I don't think a government would try to do that, even if they have different political stripes. But don't feel that you need to rush. Like, I think that the court also, like, talks about that the whole way that the act is structured, including the national standards, is to provide that breathing room, right? And or you can do it incrementally. You don't have to take on everything. You can take on little pieces of things, the things that bother you most about the system. You can take on pieces of that and then rely on the existing other mechanisms. I think Hadley's got a nice metaphor for it, but she kind of thinks about it as a layer cake, and she can explain that. So I think that would probably be one of my tops, and I'll let her say a bit more about her areas.
Yeah, I mean, I'll pick up on that, Naomi, because I agree. What we hear a lot is when Indigenous governments come to the table, they're told a lot of things that they have to do that simply aren't in the law. Like, they're simply not in the act, like Naomi is saying. There's Indigenous governments that it's being framed as if they have 1 year, but no, it's not their year. They have as long as they want to take. They can take 5 years. They can take 10 years. It's on that obligation, that push is to try to counter that power imbalance for provincial and federal governments. It's not supposed to be a time pressure for Indigenous governments. I think that yet we talk about a layer cake. So the other thing that we hear, the time push, and then we hear government saying on the other side of the table, if you want a coordination agreement, if you want your law enforced, first of all, you need a complete law drafted. People think they need a complete law drafted that addresses every single issue. But there's coordination tables going on right now where there aren't complete law drafts. Drafted, and even when there are, there's changes as that negotiation goes on. So that's not necessary. Also saying, well, you need to take on everything. You need to take on service delivery. You have to have the dispute resolution. But that's not what the Act says. The Act says you can take on all those pieces, but you don't necessarily have to do all those pieces. So that's where the layer cake, we use a layer cake example to say, okay, this is an area of in constitutional law, it's called double aspect. It's easier to picture a layer cake to say, well, an Indigenous government could decide, you know, if you think about cutting through a layer cake, that Indigenous law prevails first. So you can start there. And it doesn't need to cover absolutely everything, because the places where it doesn't cover, the national standards cover. And then the places that it doesn't cover, the provincial act would still be in force. That's the way this act was designed, to be able to have these three layers working together. And you can picture, you could have the layer cake like a wedding cake where, you know, there's a smaller, bigger, or you could have just a delicious chocolate, you know, three layer cake. Indigenous nations can occupy the entire top layer, right? But they don't need to. And I think the pressure to have to take on everything is creating tensions and creating gaps. And the Act and the Supreme Court are both really clear. I mean, again, back to Jordan's principle, there are not supposed to be gaps in services. This isn't what it's supposed to create. So I think those are things that we're hearing that just are not part of the Act.
I just want to tack on one more thing on that, which is, yeah, the rushing to made to feel that you need to, you know, essentially copy what a provincial, like take over and model a provincial, because that's available, that's there to see, or there are ways to incorporate Indigenous ways of knowing and being into this, and that will be, you know, that has the potential to be so strong. Like there's evidence that shows that, you know, culturally based programming really, really has an impact. And, you know, Hadley's organization, the Wet'suwet'en Lodge, I'm doing a little bit of work here. There's work happening throughout the country of connecting communities, reconnecting. Some places they are connected, very strongly connected. In some places there's, you know, support and work can be done to connect with stories and language and other Indigenous laws that speak to how we loved and cared for our children. And trying to incorporate that into our laws. I'm helping a group in New Brunswick who are Mi'kmaq, and we're looking at stories and looking at language. And we just found the other day, it's a word in the Mi'kmaq, my dad has a dictionary that he wrote, but there's actually a Mi'kmaq word for being rich. And it's used today to refer to somebody having money. But traditionally, when somebody was referred to, it meant somebody with a lot of children.
Oh, that's beautiful. And you know, one of the things I can agree with you so much on this, that there's this weaponizing of time that often happens from provinces and Canada. And it's almost like the shopping channel, like buy now and we'll throw in a free set of knives, but where they're going fast and there won't be any if you take your time. And one of the major questions that I ask people to really think deeply about is, what are the problems that jurisdiction can solve? Because we know the leading reasons for the dramatic overrepresentation. I'll just speak about only First Nations kids here in a minute with this. But First Nations kids are 17 times more likely to go into child welfare care because of poverty, poor housing, colonial trauma that links to addictions and domestic violence. How do you fix that with jurisdiction? Like, you could have a very good law, but unless you take account of all of these fires that fuel the overrepresentation, then you're not going to have the type of success for your families that you hoped you would. So I think this taking the cautious approach, and we know from First Nations agencies, it takes about 10 to 15 years to get up to a kind of a bit of a rhythm in terms of being able to operate and meet the needs of your community. It's not something that can happen on a dime. So I think this thing about taking your time, thinking through what jurisdiction can solve, think about what resources, funding resources can solve, and then think about what the community capacity and finding a skilled workforce out there who can do the work, because that's a challenge in any field that you're in. So one of the things I think about, so if I'm a kid on the ground, say I'm a young person and I'm in care, did that decision really change anything for me?
At the very beginning when this law came out, I think I had put something on social media, and right away I got a question from a youth in care who was an older youth saying, so what does this do for me? What does this mean? And one of the heartbreaking things I think about this act at first glance is saying, you know, for the kids that have borne the brunt, who are facing adulthood, and we know there's all these issues of when kids are aging out of care, and we know that from all these layers, because of the discrimination in First Nations funding that the Caring Society case showed to everybody else and demanded something different happen, and everything you just talked about, Cindy, we know that there are youth in care that are looking, you know, Justice Ardith Whalcom talks about radical isolation, that loneliness. So there are pieces, and I think we're actually working on a youth guide to C92. Right now it's actually written, it's at the designer to try to make it, you know, engaging for youth. And I think some of the pieces of this act are about reconnection pieces, where that's wanted, where that's important, because there is a talk about the importance of emotional ties and attachment. There is a part of the act that says both in section 11 and section 16 or 17. Now I'm going to get them mixed up. But talking about reassessment, saying, okay, there should be regular reassessment to look and see, first of all, what are the impact of child and family services? But second of all, are there family members? Are there connections that can be made? And those are, again, that requires advocacy. But I think that's a piece that is available and does exist. And again, we need those strong advocates to support youth who are wanting to access those pieces.
I think about laws. Laws are tools. You need a Swiss Army knife of tools, right? But it's giving us more tools than we had. And although all of us were critical of the act, you know, and the gaps in it when it came to pass, it does give us more tools to use to advocate for Indigenous children and families. And, you know, as we've talked about before, as we were even heading to the Supreme Court, we were fighting for Canada, we weren't arguing that C92 is perfect by any stretch. We were arguing for the ability for Canada to pass a tool like this. And so I think it's important as a tool, and it's not being used enough as a tool, particularly on the national standards. As I said earlier, I don't think enough folks know about it or that it's being used. But where I am seeing it being used in the hands of advocates and judges who have a heart and care, they are doing things with it, you know. And I think that even the definition of the Indigenous child and best interest of the of an Indigenous child that's used in the act, like that is starting to be permeated in other areas. So there are advocates and allies, let's say, who are trying to do things on the ground with it to help it make a difference. Is it solving everything? No, but it's a hopeful direction. And then it means also that we can improve these tools, right? If there's aspects of this tool that are not working, we can strengthen it, right? We know that ability is there.
Yeah. And I think that's sometimes, like, when we talk about these things, it's really important that we kind of nuance and recognize what they can and cannot do. But what the Supreme Court keeps on saying to us is that, look, you can make these promises in the sky and that's great, but you got to walk the walk. And I think that's still an area that we need to focus on and making sure that people actually have the tools to be able to implement some of these national standards across the board so that they're more promises than just some kind of hope and prayer, depending on what jurisdiction you live in. This podcast wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about something called the notwithstanding clause. And I have to tell you, you know, before a few years ago, I really didn't pay much attention to this thing. It's in the Constitution, but we've been seeing it used by provinces to get out of basically honoring the dignity and human rights for certain people within their provinces. And that's not the way it was originally intended to use. And it kind of takes them out of the, you know, the scrutiny of the charter. They can, oh yeah, it's not okay to discriminate, but we're going to do it anyway. And we don't want to be accountable to the charter because we're doing it. It's the way that my layman's way of saying it. So maybe we should have a legitimate way of explaining the notwithstanding clause from a lawyer who knows what they're doing. So I'd ask either Hadley or Naomi, what is the notwithstanding clause and can it be used by any of these provinces to basically ignore the Supreme Court ruling?
I'll start with the second question because the answer is so easy. It's no. And so you can ignore the first part of the question, which is a long answer. Well, it won't be a too long an answer. It was a mechanism to try to bring more provinces to support the charter in 1982. Quebec was against the charter in 1982, but a bunch of other provinces agreed with the federal government. But this was sort of part of getting them to agree. And it's this provision that says that certain parts of the charter and Aboriginal rights are not in the protection. Section 35 is not in the charter. It's in another part of the Constitution. But and so 33 is in the charter and it's only about certain charter rights, that being some of the fundamental freedoms like freedom of religion and freedom of expression, the right to equality. And certain protections of life, liberty, security of the person, and certain legal protections, all extremely important rights. But it does give provinces a time limit and the federal government a time limited ability to say, we're going to, you know, if this legislation violates those rights, we're allowed to do that for a time limited period of time. So it's 5 years. And then that protection that the Article 30, Section 33 gives disappears. But then it can be renewed for another 5 years. So ultimately, like potentially 10 years. And it's very problematic now because I think the idea and the way most everyone treated it for the longest time was it's as extremely exceptional. It shouldn't be invoked except in very extreme circumstances, and it shouldn't be used, but just normal because you know we have a constitutional democracy and we protect fundamental rights. But what we're seeing more recently is government starting to use it, you know, all the time. And recently, Quebec referred to it as the parliamentary sovereignty clause, which is completely inconsistent with the respect of fundamental rights. And people are getting mad about it, but it may fall either to the federal government to do something about it. They've got some powers to do something about it. Or they may go back to the Supreme Court to say, we didn't mean when we said that you could just, you know, invoke it anytime you felt like it, we're starting to see that from some provinces. So it's very concerning. But in our particular case, not a worry because it has nothing to do with Indigenous rights.
It can't affect... that is the good news. The bad news story is, I think with the rise of populism, it would be hard for the people drafting things in 1982 to imagine that it would be politically advantageous for a premier to say they were going to invoke that clause. I think they thought that that would almost trigger a provincial election. And I think that trend is disturbing. But in this case, both Indigenous rights and, Naomi, if I can say, division of powers, saying what powers provincial and federal governments have, the notwithstanding clause can't affect that. It also can't affect separation of powers, which talks about, you know, the court's role and the legislative role and the executive role. So luckily for us and luckily for this decision, it won't affect either on Indigenous rights or division of powers.
Well, that's a relief, at least for me, to know that that can't be sideswiped that way. So really, this decision is going to stand, and it really is going to color how we all work in the space of Indigenous child welfare on a go-forward basis. We're nearing the end of this. I've learned an enormous ton of things, and I'm looking forward to going on to your website, Hadley, the Wakotoan Law and Governance Lodge website, and we'll make sure that that link is in there so everyone can benefit from this. I want to turn to you, each of you, for some final thoughts on what do you think the real key takeaways are for this, and what policy implications are you thinking about that might flow from this particular decision?
A piece that I think is powerful about this decision that I'm hoping people will take away when they're thinking about for Indigenous governments and peoples thinking about exercising inherent rights in this area, and then also for provincial governments, federal governments, judges, people who are making decisions that are involved here, is that interwoven piece of this. So the Supreme Court talks about the United Nations Declaration that raising children is a center of self-determination. So I think it's not dependent. It's not, people don't need to wait for that legislation. By within the national standards, if you look at all the, and we went through when we did our judicial guide, Naomi, I, and Corin Lightning at the request of judges, we went through all these pieces in the national standards where the very best evidence would be what an Indigenous government would know and say. It would just make sense. And then, in this decision, where the Supreme Court says this legislation really binds the federal government, and I argue the provincial government, to act as if that Section 35 right exists. Naomi has coined this phrase, legislative reconciliation, that the court picked up on, that I think is so powerful. And they talk about honor of the crown, and something we don't talk about often to do with children, but we sure do when we talk about honor of the crown, is the duty to consult and accommodate. And again, if this is an inherent Aboriginal right and you're acting as if, all governments would have a duty to consult, and who they would consult with again would be that Indigenous government. And the Act says, of course, parents as well, and caregivers. So all whichever strand you start with, whether that's there is legislation drafted, whether it's a national standards, whether you're thinking about how do you act as if this is a Aboriginal and treaty right that's enshrined in the Constitution, that the starting point on all of those would be that respect. And Naomi, you talked about how often reconciliation was mentioned in this. And I think it's that respectful relations toward Indigenous governments, showing Indigenous governments that respect, and starting with asking the question and having those conversations about what Indigenous governments see are in the best interests of Indigenous children.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I did feel like the court doesn't do everything in this decision. I've said, like, as I've described it to my students, it's sort of like leaving us breadcrumbs on these broader issues of self-government and inherent rights, but it, in a way that tells us we're going to get there. And that involves not just rights, but obligations and other governments' obligations, and how it changes how we work together. And the emphasis on, the UN Declaration and reconciliation as mutually respectful relationships. Like, I did feel like the ground had shifted. We might like it we're not, it's not, a whole overnight change. But it feels like the path to a new place is in sight, and it can involve various things. It's the exercise of the inherent right to self-government, but there's also like the questions of other governments' responsibilities and our relationships with them. And also like a recognition that there's a role for governments. Like for the longest time, and this is what led to Quebec's argument in this case, was this idea, the ground has shifted in important ways. We're not seeing the whole picture yet, but we're going to move in that direction. It includes the inherent right to self-government. It also involves the role of other governments and treating Indigenous peoples differently and as they have. And we haven't figured out all the pieces of that yet, but I feel like it's moving in a more positive direction, which will include government obligations in terms of funding and treating us as Indigenous governments as more equals. Sorry, I'm not articulating that as perfectly as I should be, but I do feel like it is, there's a lot to be hopeful for. And I'm a very optimistic person by nature, but there's things to be hopeful for and a lot more tools to use to move forward. And it's not going to be easy. I'm not going to say that the roads are paved with rainbows, right? Like we're still going to have to fight and we're still going to have to argue and we're still going to have to, in some cases, take other governments to court and this sort of thing. But I think the toolbox that we have to do that's a lot bigger than it was before this decision.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. And I'm just so grateful that the two of you were able to join us today. I remember Elmer Crishane, the late Elmer Crishane, who was a big guide to us nationally. He would say when it came to children that we had to go beyond justice, that we had to achieve loving justice. And that decision was the closest thing I've seen to loving justice since the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal's repeated decisions. That was, to me, the tribunal really opened the door on loving justice. The very first words in their decision for 2016 is, this is about children. And I think that we're starting to see that become more mainstream in the courts. And I'm hoping that that will continue to build. I would love to have the two of you back when we get the Dominique decision out. There's also a big decision coming out on the Dixon case. There's a bunch of things at the Supreme Court that'll impact our kids going forward. And we're going to all see how much in alignment the federal and provincial and territorial governments are actually going to be with the decision over time. So I would love to invite you both back.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.